Welcome to all.
You want a gavel?
Thank you. I know you're all having fun out there, but sorry, got to squash it. No, we're going to have fun here, too.
We got to squash it with a meeting.
Squash the fun.
You know, what can I say?
There's nothing. Move on.
Welcome to the Mesa City Council study session, fun study session, for the morning of Thursday, April 15th, 2010. We'd like to begin this morning's meeting by reviewing the agenda for the upcoming or cunning, whatever you want to say it, council meeting for next Monday. Page 2. Page 3.
Mayor.
Councilmember Higgins.
Item 4A. Discussing the municipal court building's furniture. To my recollection on this item, I thought we had, or you had gone and gathered furniture for all the vacant offices to fill your building. Is that, that's part of a story?
That's part of the story, but it's a long story.
Okay, and we're going to make it a short story okay. Now, right?
Cliff notes.
Mayor, members of council, we pulled everything out of the old building, even if it was bolted to the walls. We pulled it, and we backfilled it into the new building. It's a huge building, three times the size of the old building, so we have employed every stick of furniture we could bring over from the old building. What you're seeing here is primarily furniture that's in the public spaces that just can't go anymore. I mean, the furniture that's in the lobby right now, if you sit on it, stuffing flies out from under the cushions. So you're looking at public space furniture, the lobby, the courtrooms, the hallways where you need public seating, and those high volume, high use spaces. So we made every effort to try to match quality to use so that we wouldn't have to be looking at replacing this furniture 5-10 years from now. It's a long-term effort.
And do we always buy furniture with bond funds? I thought that was unusual because, I mean, you don't at home, so.
Morning, Mayor, Council. When we're doing a full new facility, we always do fixtures, furniture, and equipment as part of the overall project cost when we're doing a brand new one.
And is that, like, what kind of life do we have on office furniture? Is it that long? Is it a 20-year? Like you said, some of this furniture is actually 25 years old.
That's correct.
I mean, this is going to be extended use, heavy use furniture.
Okay. Bear in mind that we had 270,000 people come through the court building last year, and that looks to continue. One thing I might also mention that helped this situation, towards the end of the building project, budget was tight. We were struggling for funds, as you might imagine. I was able to secure a $265,000 technology grant to finish a lot of the technology infrastructure in the building, which in turn maybe freed up a little money for furnishings. I couldn't do a grant for furnishings, but I could for technology. So this kind of helped that situation quite a bit.
All right, thanks.
Councilmember Fender.
Thank you, Mayor. And I had the opportunity to visit, had some same questions. You went from originally $1 million to try and furnish this building.
Yes, sir. When we looked at this 4+ years ago as to what it would take to furnish this building this size, of course, economic circumstances were different. We were looking at additional staff, additional operations. I think the number was around $1 million to fully furnish the building. Of course, things have changed over the last 4 years, and we have, you know, done all that we could to get down to the number that you see, which is primarily those high volume, critical need public areas that we have to have the furniture.
And that's the point I wanted to make. A dramatic change in how we're doing things. You're utilizing old furniture. You went and got a grant to be able to subsidize. And so you're, you know, it should be celebrated. You're doing a good job, and I appreciate you getting there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything else on page 3? Page 4? Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, item number 4F. About the
wait, you can't say that until you say real fast trailer mounted towable articulating boom lift.
Sure, new trailer mounted towable articulating boom lift, no problem. I've had 3 cups of coffee already, so good morning. Quick question,
please proceed.
It seems to me that in the city of Mesa somewhere, we have a trailer-mounted towable articulating boom lift. You know, do we have one somewhere in the city? Does anyone know? I mean, we currently change streetlights. Do we do that ourselves? So of our parks, and you know, again, we're looking at budgets, so I just every time I look at a expenditure, do we already have that in-house, and can't we, hey, we need lights changed at this park, and the truck's out doing a streetlight, and they go do the other thing. So I just can't. And then on top of that, we seem to outsource lots, and in this case, we're bringing it back in-house, so it's kind of odd.
Mark, go ahead and explain why we're doing that, the cost savings as a result of that.
The cost savings, Mayor, Council, morning. The purchase of $37,000, this piece of equipment is not used to change the ball field lights. It'll be used to change the trail lights, the parking lot lights. We're currently, PRCF alone is spending about $30,000 a year. Facility maintenance is close to another $10,000 a year. The piece of equipment that you're referring to, obviously, with my newness to the city, I'm still learning that myself, so I'll have to refer to Mr. Friedlein.
Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, I think the booms you're talking about that we have, they're $100,000 pieces of equipment that are out in the street every day. We do share as much as we can with the other utilities. This is a much less expensive, it would be very inadequate to use a trailer-mounted boom for what we have in use, and would be overkill, and we wouldn't have the available time or resources to do the things for parks.
There isn't the volume capability to use the equipment we have.
It appears to be that way.
Right, and it would be taking equipment that's really for a higher use that needs to be used for those things, for the higher end, and actually literally higher components. What we're trying to do here is we've studied it and looked at how much we're spending to contract out for the service and recognize that just by adding this piece of equipment, we can actually save money for the city at the end of the day.
Because when you contract out, you pay a premium for the equipment charge.
Right. And Mayor, Council, again, a one-year payback on this piece of equipment with what we're paying, and we're looking at a 15-year or more life expectancy for the piece of equipment.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else on page four? Councilmember Higgins.
4G, a really quick question on RICO funds. You guys, who's
the question?
The question is, can RICO funds only be used for capital expenditures, or could they be used for programming? No, what? Capital only. Awesome.
Yeah, and it's supplemental. Mr. Chief Danny, come on up, Chief, real quickly. It's supplemental, correct?
Yes.
It's supplemental. It can't be supplanting. It has to be supplemental.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Chief.
On your head.
That was good.
I do that again if you like. And no slide. It was awesome.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
On 4G, I just want to point out, too, that the purchase of those motorcycles is through Kelly's Kawasaki, a Mesa business, and that's pointed out in the agenda.
And one last thing on page
yes,
four. And that's 4H. And I have a question. It's just a sentence that's in this report that didn't make a lot of sense. Can I read it? I think this is being fully funded by air quality grants, so the cars aren't right. However, there's a sentence that says the city's local share funding for this project, if needed, is available from the adopted street bonds project. So what is that? Either it's funded by grant funding or it's not funded by grant funding. I didn't understand that.
Good morning.
Morning, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins. Originally, this is one of our federal aid projects that we've got programmed through MAG. And originally, we had the estimate of what we thought it was going to cost. Part of that was taken up by the federal funds, and part of it was a local match. Through a closeout, was it closeout process? Yeah, closeout process, we actually got that converted fully to federal funding. And I think the comment was just the original local share is not dedicated to anything else. It's still there in case there was some unforeseen change order or anything encountered during the construction of the project. The federal funds are capped, but if something unforeseen comes up, we still have that original local money available if it's needed.
Another great move by staff.
Okay, thank you. Page 5. Page 6. Are you raising your hand or scratching your head? Oh, that's okay. Or just twitching. Or just a caffeine twitch.
Page six. Councilmember Summers.
Oh, my God.
I don't know how I follow that. Item 5D on consent. It is an item for rezoning. Has met with some significant opposition. However, since this is only the introduction of the ordinance, I'm going to leave it on consent for Monday. And there's a legal protest, so it will be an independent item on 2 weeks from now.
And we may have citizens show up, and in that case, we'll, of course,
sure
pull it off.
Happen.
But once again, this is just the introduction of the ordinance.
Yeah, yes. There is a leadership of this particular neighborhood. I'm not anticipating anybody showing up for anything on Monday.
Okay. Page 7, Councilmember Higgins.
Unless, go ahead. 5E, I can ask John this. The suspension of either the signage or the newspaper is only regarding the zoning code update. And if there are other things that come forward, we're still doing both. They're still required to do both. So just applies to the zoning code update?
Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, the way the ordinance is drafted here, it does take the and make it an or. And so for the couple of months that we'll be finishing up using this code before the new code's adopted, it would apply to anything. We would still encourage, though, any zoning applications that come in to post that sign, because we do know it's very important to the citizens. That's the way they really find out about those individual zoning cases. Pretty slow right now in terms of zoning cases. We don't really expect to have very many, but the applicants that we have are understand the importance of that citizen involvement, and I'm sure we'll get them if there are any to post that sign.
Okay, so I guess I missed something there. You will. So we're amending the zoning ordinance to allow either the posting or a newspaper advertisement. Right now it requires both.
Correct.
And you're doing this because we're going to have multiple postings for the comprehensive revision of zoning ordinance, but you're going to encourage applicants that when they, but there will be no requirement.
During this 2 month period, it would be the or.
Okay. So it's just a 2 month.
Right. As soon as we adopt the new code, it contains the same provision.
Okay. I got you.
And we can't have something special just for this? For this zoning code rewrite because of its special needs?
We can't have something?
Well, I mean, I don't like the fact that we're suspending it for other cases coming in. I mean, this is a very unique situation. It's not really relating to a specific parcel. It's the whole zoning code. So we can't have anything special for us.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, there's still the citizen participation requirements that are required for any zoning case, and every applicant that comes in is required to submit a citizen participation plan. As part of that plan, we would very, 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 very strongly encourage the applicant to include posting as part of that requirement. This would suspend the making it mandatory for that. Staff will still place a newspaper ad for all of the applications that go through.
Well, but I think the question is, Gordon, can't you exempt out the fact that what the impact of updating the planning or the zoning code versus an individual coming and making application? Can you treat the larger revision different than the individual application?
Mr. Brady, Councilman, no, you cannot. It's a legal requirement.
Okay, well, my question is this, because here's what I'm afraid of. If it's an either or, and I understand the strongly suggest, I don't like when we're into strongly suggesting, and I think that posting on a property for when you talk about the ability of neighbors who are the ones who are primarily affected, that's what they see. That's what they respond to. That and the neighborhood meetings and the official notification for those who live within 300 feet. What we're saying is that if you know, we don't post on any property for a change in the zoning ordinance. Correct. There's no property to post. We're changing the ordinance.
That's the proposal with this ordinance change.
Right. But if you have a property that's coming in for a rezone, why can't we just state that you have to post on the property, and that's still a requirement, but they have their option for the next 2 months not to post on it? I mean, I'm trying to figure out how that affects us, since we're not posting on a property for changes in the zoning ordinance. Did I just adequately confuse you?
Well, no. We had this same discussion internally several times.
Oh, you didn't come to my conclusion?
Well,
Mayor, we wore them down.
Yes. There is a train of thought where when we do the kind of...
How did light rail get into this discussion? Go ahead.
Why don't we switch tracks?
Hey!
There's a train of thought where when you do the comprehensive revisions to the code that we're proposing, some people consider that activity in and of itself a rezoning activity, as opposed to what we would normally see when a person comes in and tries to rezone a property from one zoning district to another zoning district.
Okay.
Because of the comprehensive nature of that, and because of that train of thought that goes along with that, if we were to sit here and adopt a new zoning code, we would be responsible under the present language to go out and basically post every single parcel of land within the city right now. And that's just a practical impossibility in order to meet the legal test.
I think it's not only a practical impossibility, I think you're really stretching reality there.
Sure.
I mean, you know, there comes a point, I get where you're coming from, and that sounds great for a classroom or some meeting where you're sitting around talking about the potential. I'm going to ask you, do you really think that the amendments to the zoning ordinance would be at risk if we didn't post on every single property in the city of Mesa?
Mayor, there is a legal risk.
Some.
I'm asking. There's always legal risk in everything. From a realistic standpoint, do we think that the legal risk is real or significant that our zoning ordinance would be upheld or would be held up, not upheld, but held up by that requirement? I mean, let's put it this way. I'm more worried, and I don't know where we're getting, I'm more worried of the fact that we have a developer that, even though they're strongly encouraged, chooses not to physically post on a property and comes in for a zoning change. And therefore, everyone driving past that doesn't know that there's a zoning change. I think the risk is much greater there for the community and for the immediate community than the legal risk that we might have by looking at a nuance in the law that says somebody could technically say you can't change this. Because, you know, who's the affected party if we change the zoning ordinance?
Mayor, why don't we do this? Let's hold off on this discussion. Let's go back. Because I have some questions, and let's talk about this maybe back on Monday, because we make zoning changes in the code all the time across a variety of different things, and we don't post them.
Yeah.
So let us talk about it, because I hear the council's major concern is it's allowing individual zoning applications to come in that would not have to meet the current notification process. I mean, and if anything else, what I'm hearing is the weight should be certainly to the posting of the sign.
Yeah,
I personally
think the physical posting of an individual zoning case is something that I'm not really that thrilled
about.
Let's
step this way. I know we're going to be rushed for time today, so let's pull this item back and then bring it back and have a conversation with council. Okay.
Councilman Summers.
Last point on that before we let it go. Since these are rezonings and they are legislative act of this body, can this body then consider if an individual doesn't post a sign on the property that we might be concerned about proper notification, and therefore we can deny the zoning request?
Councilman Summers, certainly. Anytime that the council or the planning commission thinks that they are not that the public is not adequately advised, just like right now,
I'm not making any faces.
Right now, if the council or the planning commission doesn't think that the applicant has adequately notified the citizens in the area through the citizen participation plan, the planning commission or the council can send him back to do some more notification. So you have that opportunity right now.
So I'm not going to get a circular argument on that one. So let's pull it back, okay? Because I see what you're saying. There's no way this council is going to change an ordinance that says you don't have to post and then have an applicant come in and say, we're going to deny you because you didn't post. That's just not going to happen. So let's put some more. I get where you're coming from, and I appreciate that. I just think that there's a disconnect between the machinations of an ordinance and reality as to what we're going to accomplish. And I think we just need to bring those more into line.
Okay.
Thank you so much. So yeah, let's pull that one and let's bring it back, okay? Councilmember Fenter.
Yes, sir. If you were going to ask any other items on page 7, 5F and 6B, I support the opportunity to delegate some of this authority about easements and how we do those. It would be nice if this is successful, that the City Council's office could be notified about 6B. This is a great program. It's an ongoing alley abandonment program and gating of the alleys, and really successful. It's good to know that's going on. As a council member, I'd love to just be informed. So if there's a way to kind of heads us up and say, hey, we're doing so many in this area, but I'm fine with not having it on the agenda and not having it time consuming. So if there's a way to just to let us know that that's going on.
Mayor, Councilmember Finter,
yeah.
5F does not apply to 6B. Under okay. state law, we have to bring those to council to do anyway.
Oh, those still stay.
Yeah, I can't vacate
oh, okay.
under state law.
And that was the mistake on my part. So two different things.
Property. And it would just be for city-owned property. For instance, if we had a well site, we need to get power to it. SRP yeah. needs an easement for the power. This allows us to have Chris grant the easement instead of doing all the, you know, bringing it forward and then taking the time to do it. So
thank you for that clarification. That's perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else on page 7? Thank you. Page 8. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Mayor, with regard to item 6J, this is an application by the Child Crisis Center for tribal grant monies. Even though I'm the president of the Child Crisis Center Board, city attorney has advised that I don't have a conflict of interest on this particular issue. No direct financial interest in the matter, so it can stay on consent. But just in case anybody had questions, knowing of my involvement with the center, I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else on page 8? Page 9. Councilmember Richens.
I have to give an apology to Councilmember Summers. I had was having a conversation with a nearby property owner of this 8B and 8C. And they're changing some stuff in the subdivision plat, and there was some concern that some of the new placements of the buildings might affect adjacent property owners. And so I was thinking maybe that we should require what we were talking about earlier. Maybe they should have another public participation type thing so they can have the opportunity to explain the changes on that. So at least perhaps we should hold off consent.
Okay.
Mayor, and I just wanted to concur with Councilmember Richens' suggestions on these two items.
Okay, 8B and 8C will be pulled off consent. Okay, anything else? Thank you. All right. Number 2 here, presentation, discuss, provide direction regarding zoning ordinance update. Mr. Sheffield.
Mayor, council members. The to use a sports analogy, I think we're in the bell lap of this project. Last week you were we distributed what we refer to as the public review draft of the zoning code update. A lot of work gone into this. There are some fairly significant changes that are being proposed with this document. What I'm doing today is basically going through and taking care of a couple of housekeeping items. One we've already discussed about the posting requirements as well as the notice requirements. I'll kind of pass over that real quick. There's a second follow-up amendment to that where we're proposing some name and abbreviation changes to help facilitate the adoption of the code a little bit later on. We're going to talk a little bit about infill as well as a new chapter within the proposed code that directly addresses infill questions. So the combination of the PAD and the DMP overlay districts. We're going to talk about home occupations a little bit, churches in downtown, as well as some of the schedule that we're doing for the public review. In terms of the update itself, we've heard some conversation from folks about what kind of code we're having. Wanted to let you know, this is not a form-based code. This is a modification of what's called a Euclidean type of code, if you have to classify these things in planning terms. The form-based code, we have an entire section of the code reserved for a form-based code that's going to be developed by a consultant that's been hired as part of the Central Main Street plan. That's forthcoming. So we're not ignoring that. It is coming. There is going to be a form-based code. It's just the overall totality of this particular zoning code is not a form-based code, and we wanted to make sure that was clear and people understood what was going on, or kind of maybe, I don't want to say downplay the expectation, but make sure everybody understood what the expectations were going to be. In addition to that, we talked a little bit about the public notice revisions. I'll skip over that because we're going to, I guess, talk about that on Monday. The second thing I wanted to talk about, I handed out a table today. It says table one at the top, and it talks about amended zoning district names and zoning district abbreviations. Looks like this. The basic idea behind this is to sit here and try to facilitate some of the name changes that are being proposed as part of the code update. We're trying to go to names that more fairly describe the district itself. There's only a few of those change. For example, particularly in the downtown area, there's several of those where we no longer call it Town Center. We call it Downtown Mesa, so we're changing the name of the district to reflect that. In addition to that, we're proposing several initial changes or abbreviation changes for each of this so that the initials or the nomenclature that describes each of the zoning districts on the maps itself are a little bit more intuitive. And so when you have a restricted multiple residence district, we're calling it RM2, or the M being multiple residence. In the single residence districts, we're using the term S to designate single residence. And in the commercial districts, we have the office, the neighborhood, limited, and general. All those basically reflect the existing names that are being proposed. That's an ordinance that you'll see proposed for introduction, not at the next meeting, but the meeting, your next council meeting after that. I believe it's the first one in May. Any questions about that?
Councilmember Richardson.
I believe in some of the documents we've been reading about mixed-use districts and how you're treating those. I don't see that on this list.
The list that you see right now only reflects the existing code. When you actually go forward with the proposed public review draft, if you were to read this, there are three mixed-use districts that are already in that code. We're not changing anything right now. That will come when the larger codes gets adopted. Okay. Infill. Basically, we've put together what's referred to as Chapter 18, the actual proposed chapter I've kind of given as a handout as well. The idea basically is to try to encourage the development or the redevelopment of bypass parcels, as well as encourage mixtures activities, and to try to sit here and make use of the existing utility infrastructure that the city has within the interior of the city itself. There's two actual variations of the infill district that's proposed. One's called an IND1. That has to do with some of the smaller sites, generally less than 5 acres. Typically, we think of these as more as the single parcel sites, particularly the ones that are on the vacant corners. The IND2 is more for people who want to assemble land or larger parcels, and we give them a little bit more wide-ranging options because there's a little bit more things that you can do with larger parcels. Taking advantage of a particular state law that's called the Infill Development Incentive District, the IDID. This is an ARS 949910. Instead of having to declare an area a redevelopment area, we declare it an infill area, and all we have to do is find three of the seven items that are listed. There's a high percentage of vacant buildings, a high percentage of vacant land, obsolete land uses, a high percentage of uses, nuisance on the property, the absence of development, high occurrence of crime, or decline in population. What you'll notice is there's an absence of a specific designation of the site for blight. Okay, that tends to have a negative connotation. We remove that from this particular thing. We still get to sit here and do some things that are a little bit different than what we would do otherwise in other portions of the city.
Councilman Richens.
Is this list from the Arizona Revised Statutes,
yes,
or is this our own list?
No, this is from the statute.
Is blight in the statute, and we removed it for our purposes?
No, purposes of the infill district, blight is not a consideration.
Oh, okay. And so we've lifted that directly and placed it
here.
Yes. Great. Thank you.
Again, the two districts. The difference basically is that when you come in with the IND1 with the smaller districts, you come in and you say, I'm going to do something based on, and you actually designate a certain zoning district that the city already has. And so you're working from existing code. You don't have to come up with different planning documents in order to do that. You can request modifications to any standard, and when we mean any standard, not only just talking about the zoning district standards, but we're also talking about engineering standards, we're also talking about off-site standards. And corresponding to this particular chapter, there would also be modifications made in the portion of the city code that affects the off-site requirements that would authorize both the city engineer and the city traffic engineer to enter in negotiations and make those kinds of recommendations. Now, the difference in this is that we would bring these together as a package. In the IND 2, there's a little bit more work done up front, because what you would do is come through, similar to what we did with the Planned Community District or the DMB project, you would come up with your own planning documents. You would develop your own land use requirements, you would develop your own development standards and those types of things, and we would negotiate all of those things together in a package as well. So you have two options based on the size of the parcel. And again, we're negotiating the whole package. It's not just the zoning requirements, it's all of the off-sites, it's all of the engineering that goes along with that. The foundational premise of this basically is that on the smaller sites, there's less planning work that's done up front. You can sit here and base it on something that's already in the code. So you don't have to sit here and think through all of those types of things. Whereas in the IND2 project, there is some more work that's done up front, but again, we're negotiating the whole package and we're starting from scratch. And so we don't have to sit here and filter through anything for some of those other types of parcels. Typically, the smaller sites, we can use a classification that's already in the code, so that's generally not an issue until you get into the larger sites. We're looking for things that are the best fit or the context of the property, and the whole idea behind this is that not only does the council presented with a zoning package, the council is also presented with the engineering or the off-site package. The whole thing comes to you together as a package, and so you make a legislative decision on both of the items at the same time, because you can see the totality of the development, you see the totality of the impacts for the project itself.
Well, when you say the engineering comes here, that's just the engineering plan. I mean, we're not talking, because you're doing an overall plan. So
we're talking about the right-of-way requirements, the curb and gutter, the sidewalk, stormwater, kind of things. The whole thing.
Gotcha. The general guidelines that relate to those.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So the incentives of this basically are that the applicant gets to choose his land use options. We negotiate everything as a package. There's potential for negotiating of streamlining of plan reviews, as well as partnering options for off-site improvements. The benefits for this, basically, again, to the city, maximizing the use of underutilized parcels. We get to make use of the existing infrastructure that's already in the street that serves the surrounding area. Again, we're encouraging investment and reinvestment into neighborhoods. And we're trying to minimize sprawl, because we're basically directing the growth back toward the interior of the city, instead of sitting here and trying to reinvest on the edges or try to extend existing utility infrastructure. We have an evaluation criteria for this, similar to what we did for the Planned Community District. So rather than just kind of haphazardly decide upon these types of things, one of the things we would do for the off-site improvements is, rather than an equivalent level of service, which is a relatively high standard, we're going to propose that we have an adequate level of service. We'll still serve the public interest from that standpoint, but it may not necessarily be equivalent to the types of standards that we have elsewhere. For that reason alone, we think that might achieve a little bit smaller hurdle for people to follow or to get over in terms of some of the infill sites on the engineering side of the equation. We have a standard for that, and you can see that as well. The evaluation on the zoning side basically conforms to the other types of things that you would normally see for zoning. Conforms to the general plan. There's a statement of need because of the applicability criteria. We integrate, probably make sure that it integrates well into the neighborhood. It's not going to sit here and stand out. It integrates well into the existing infrastructure. We're not sitting here oversizing things in order to facilitate this type of activity. It is consistent with the context of the property, the context of the area. There's a quality to the plan that's high, and basically the quality of the plan would justify some of the deviations from the code that are being authorized on the other side of this, as well as being compatible and making sure the impact of the property works with the context of the area that's around it. So any questions about infill?
Hey, Councilman Fenter.
Could you give just a hypothetical example of maybe a piece of property in Mesa that everyone understands, and how, if this is adopted, how this would work to make that more successful or make that come into play? Is there like Site 17, or is it something around Fiesta Mall, how would this be utilized? I mean, what do you see?
A couple of different examples. One would be there's a gas station that's gone vacant on the corner. And it's been vacant for a while. It was developed back in the mid-1980s, and it's built to the 55-foot right-of-way standard. The city's existed with those existing improvements for that particular property, but according to the transportation plan, it's been designated as a road widening project for some time. But however, if a person comes in and tries to redevelop that parcel, some of the existing requirements that we have now would sit here and make that person responsible for significant road improvements that may sit here and actually either equal half to the whole cost of what he was doing on his whole project just to do the offsites. And so we might negotiate the offsites on that to work with the existing or do some sort of partial in-lieu payment or sit here and somehow partner with him on the offsites. And at the same time, we would sit here and zone and use negotiate some of the setback standards or the height standards or those types of things and bring those together to the council as a package so they see both of the off-site negotiations as well as the on-site negotiations. And that would happen.
And the unintended consequence of our current use, because the widening of the street seems to take precedent over the land use, is that we'll never have anything other than an abandoned gas station there.
Correct.
Because the current process to be so regulatorily stuck on the widening of the street, no one's going to make that investment because it just doesn't make sense. They'll go somewhere else where they don't have to widen the street. So that infill piece will forever remain vacant until we change our policy. Yeah, Councilman Higgins.
Does this avoid like going to the Board of Adjustment for a lot of things and the variance and the skip and the dips and all?
Correct. That? This would be kind of a supplement. We would keep the dip and the skip process because there are circumstances where, quite frankly, we don't have to negotiate the offsite. So we still have that tool in our toolkit. Okay. And we can still take those applications to the Board of Adjustment if we want to. However, for other sites, we can sit here and bring this together to the council as a package and make this a legislative option rather than a Board of Adjustment option.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Gordon. Would the adoption of this measure apply to large sites such as the Fiesta Village site, Hamlet School, and Southern?
It could. That would qualify as one of the as an ID IND or ID 2 type of project where they would come in and basically write their own code.
And perhaps could facilitate redevelopment of that site.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think any of those sites along Southern Avenue. I've seen some brainstorming plans where, for example, they create a street system within a site that would not at all be allowable under the current standards, but we want to do those kind of, because they're big enough that maybe it's good to create a main street type of a thing or some other kind of access that you couldn't do under the current scheme.
Another way to think about this is that the plan is the code. So when a person comes in and they present us with a plan, the plan that gets adopted by the council.
Well, it's a down-up approach rather than a top-down approach, whereas now we have a top-down where we designate what you can do, which basically restricts what you can do in there. I mean, that's the purpose of the plan, is to define what you can do. And what we've done is that we've stifled the creativity and imagination and the investment flexibility, whereas what we're saying is we want people to be able to come in and look at a site and create it from the ground up, and that way we open up the flexibility and allow creative juices to go. And granted, it still has to fit within the general ideas of what we want in that area and what mixes with the surrounding properties, but it allows the property, like you said, to define that. Is that accurate?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. Real quickly in the zoning code update, we're proposing to merge the development master plan overlay and the PAD overlay. What we've noticed as we went through on a line-by-line basis is they both had the same purpose and intent. They both had the same regulatory activity. We felt the reason the DMP was created is to allow conceptual land uses. Well, we built a conceptual land use option into the PAD process. It means that we might have to process cases a little bit better, but rather than having a multiplicity of overlay district, we're combining those two. Want to let you know about that. Home occupations, this is one of those kind of tricky types of uses. Right now, the existing zoning code defines them as accessory uses in a residential district. What we're proposing here and what I put up on the screen is what the existing language of the code says. Basically, it's subordinate to the residential use. It contributes to the residential use. It's located on the same lot or parcel. Includes typical things like swimming lessons and babysitting, as well as being people able to use their phones or their bedrooms as an office. What we've added to this basically is that provides some, it's an interpretation rather than a listing type of thing. Rather than saying every single type of activity that a person can possibly think of to do in their home and try to list those types of things, basically this becomes an interpretation. And so if a person comes in and proposes something that reasonably works within the neighborhood, it doesn't seem to negatively impact the neighborhood, then the possibility is it could be considered a home occupation. What we have done is we've excluded things. We've tried to sit here and set where the boundaries are. You can't do car repair. You can't have something that would require an employee to drive to the site. You can't have something that would involve commercial warehousing or commercial storage. There would be no non-resident employee working in the home. We would basically prohibit people from manufacturing things that involved hazardous products.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. I have a problem property in my district now that I think violates the current code where this person is renting kayaks and boats out of his backyard. This change would not permit that activity under the new code, would it?
No, it would not. If the person wanted to engage in that type of activity, they would be limited to an office at their home. They would basically have to be required to take any of the kayaks or any of those types of things and store them someplace off-site and deliver them directly to whoever their client would be.
And I have another property that where an owner is dispatching taxi cabs out of a residential unit and maintaining drivers and cabs at the site. Again, this change would not permit that activity.
No, it would not, because that would, it would, again, we're prohibiting non-resident employees from actively being part of that property.
Well, using that as an example, though, if the person wanted to sit in their house, dispatch, and never have a taxi cab or employee come to their house, that's permitted because it doesn't affect the neighbors. You don't have employees driving up and cabs driving up and everything. So that would be allowed because it happens inside the home and doesn't bother anyone outside the home. But the second that they start having taxi cabs drive up and employees sitting around waiting, now it affects the neighborhood, so that would then be covered by this. Okay. Councilmember Higgins.
How about the houses in the historic district that have been changed, the use, and it's simply for a business or a warehouse? Or how does that fit in?
In the downtown area, there's a specific allowance. Well, for all historic properties that are considered what called a level one historic home or a historic property based on a survey that was done in 1984, they have the option to come in and request a special use permit to convert that to an office. That's a special policy that prior council set up in order to sit here and try to give an alternative use to allow the preservation of a historic site. Those are considered exceptions to the code. That's not a normal circumstance.
Okay. Thank you.
Any others? Okay. Places of worship in the downtown core. This is a topic that came up a couple of different times. We're proposing to actually prohibit this particular type of activity within the downtown core area. Now, every other zoning district in the city allows churches by right. What we're talking about is basically making a restriction on a very, very tiny portion of the overall city. The calculation on this is basically 0.002% of the overall land area of the city. The basic concern on this is a 300-foot separation requirement for liquor licenses, that if you put a church there, basically it makes it difficult for an entertainment use to go in there. And if you're trying to concentrate your entertainment uses in the downtown core, the churches tend to run counter to that because of the liquor license requirement. There are two locations. This is a map that we have that show the existing locations of churches within this particular area. These two sites would become non-conforming if this became a prohibition. The other option that we have for this is to sit here and make it a council use permit option. And so rather than being a by right activity, they would still be able to apply to the council to see if they could actually locate within the town.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish. I think it's important. I'm wondering if we're overthinking this and creating a bigger mess. Because in reality, what we're trying to do is we have let's say Main Street, and we're looking at specific examples where we have churches who come into what previously were commercial uses, and basically by moving in there, they cast a their shadow, and they basically deny the rights of other businesses along Main Street or in the downtown area to pursue what they want to pursue. Mm-hmm. So basically, and that's not something we cannot control because the 300-foot limit is embedded in state liquor law. And so I understand that we don't want that. It's not so much we want to promote downtown as much as we want to keep churches from coming in and moving into a building that was never planned as a church, was not used previously as a church, is now used as a church, and now they're denying, by being there, they deny the rights of others. Mm-hmm. And by denying the rights of others, they impede what we want to accomplish in downtown, which is downtown is an entertainment district by nature. And isn't that really, am I misunderstanding what we're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, at least from what we're looking at, we're not necessarily denying churches from being in the downtown area because there are churches on the border of this particular district. It's just it's within this very, very narrow area between.
Well, but what we want to do is we want to really, on a case by case, we want them to come in and not by, you know, the collateral damage is they move in here to get a building and all of a sudden they mess everybody else up, not because of what they do in there, but because of the interaction with state liquor law, which creates this unintended consequence and which then gets embellished. And now all of a sudden you can't have liquor anywhere in downtown Mesa because you have the city that's being, you know, that's not it at all.
No.
So I'm wondering if the council use permit isn't.
That's why if that's the consensus of the council, that's an easy fix.
Councilmember Fenton, I think you had a comment.
Well, and I thought we had a legislative effort afoot to try and work with the legislature to get some exemptions, and there was, I don't know where we're at or if that died in the process, but
we've made multiple attempts.
Yeah, yeah, it's been tried for many, many years and has died every time.
Yeah, I'm supportive of the mayor's suggestion. I'm just apprehensive of some of the unintended consequences or perceptions. So,
Councilmember Higgins?
So what you're saying is your council use permit, instead of absolutely saying no right off the top.
Yeah, instead of drawing lines and having that we state what our objective is and we make it a council use permit. So that any church that wants to have a use, I mean, I don't know if this is possible, and any church that wants to locate understands that going in, and then we can decide whether that affects the business or not. It's an objective standard. If you're going to negatively impact others' rights by not allowing them uses that, but for your presence there, they would be allowed to be there, then we can handle that. I don't know whether we're where we are, and maybe that's something that needs to be looked at a little bit more before we move on. But
so this doesn't have, this is just a question. So say I have a restaurant in downtown Mesa, and a church comes in on Sunday morning to use it. Because I'm just letting them use my, it's not the same thing, right? It's not the same thing as a church owning a property. Likened to some restaurants in the city who on the.
It's kind of a chicken and egg type of thing. What came first? If the restaurant was already there and the church moves closer than 300 feet. Then
no, I mean like moves inside, like I own the building. Yeah, and
yeah, I mean you can double use the space, sure.
But the church couldn't own it because then it would be affected.
Well, the church couldn't get a liquor license. Unless it was.
And frankly, you know, it's we had the church that was in the Nile, great group of people, but the unintended consequence was they moved into what had been used as a performing arts, and then you have to go 300 feet out. And not that people can't serve liquor within that 300 feet, and that's another thing, because they still can get a restaurant license. They just can't get a they couldn't put a sports bar, and that was one of the issues that came up. They'd have to get a restaurant license, which then requires the, 60-40 split or 40-60. And so it limits what they can do. Councilman Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I actually prefer the staff initial recommendation. I think that's a cleaner and safer approach because, as we know from other discussions on council use permits, the issue of perception is the one that can divide us in whether or not to approve. And I think we run the risk of arbitrary decisions, or people will claim we're making arbitrary decisions. I think the cleanest approach, the safest approach, is just a simple ban in a very small area. That way everybody knows, and then council doesn't later have the risk of making arbitrary decisions or having difficult decisions to make because of our own perception of what that particular church might be.
Councilmember Cowan, talk me into it.
Okay.
Let's just make sure that we make it as simple as possible and make it as well-defined and don't overkill it as much we can. I would feel comfortable with that. Okay. I just want to make sure that before somebody goes in there, they know what's going on, and that we don't allow one group to overshadow the rights of other groups. And that's what happens when a church comes in after the fact. And it's not that a restaurant isn't there, but now that property owner is limited in their use of what that is. So as long as we make it as simple as possible, I would agree with Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Okay. So as I understand the consensus of council, we should continue with the prohibition.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're fine.
Okay. Now the kind of the ending. We're into our public workshop phase. We intend to have public workshops on dedicated topics once a week between now and the beginning of June. You can see the schedule that's there. We wanted to make you aware of that. Those meetings are actually in this particular room, the lower level council chambers. And you can see the schedule. You can also go to mesaaz.gov and click on the highlights page, and you'll also see the schedule as well as being able to download the entire public review draft of the zoning code. This, again, goes into May, where we start talking about employment and downtown. We're going to repeat the single residence workshop that we held last Monday, as well as having a board hearing schedule. We'll talk about this with the Design Review Board on May 5th and June 2nd. With the Economic Development Advisory Board on May 4th, as well as continue our conversations with the Planning and Zoning Board at their regular meetings on April 21st, May 19th, and June 16th, as well as having a special comment session of the P&Z Board on June 9th.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Gordon?
It's going to be a big sign to put all those.
A big sign to put all those.
All those dates on. That's a great.
Thanks,
public outreach,
Dave. Gordon, and thank you. And once again, thanks to the. Thanks to all the work you guys do. This is some great stuff happening in our
more pictures
development services, so we appreciate that. Okay, next item on the agenda is to hear budget discussions. We'll start with Parks and Recreation. Mr. Mark.
Thank you, Mayor. Again, Mayor, Council, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to present our budget recommendations with you and highlight some of the opportunities that we see that come out of this some of the reductions we're looking at. Again, slide one.
Mark, if you could introduce your.
I'm sorry. With me is Stacy Cheney Thompson, our fiscal analyst for our department. Thank you, Mayor. When you look at the Parks, Recreation, Commercial Facilities budget, it's important to remember that the department is funded by several different funds, including the general fund and also some enterprise funds. So when we're looking at the reductions, what we're really highlighting is the effect to the general fund and those dollars that come out of that. So while our net reductions for our proposed 10-11 budget are $850,539, the net effect to the general fund is $756,022, or a net reduction of 5.65% of the department's general fund budget. Some of those cuts reductions that we've recommended fall into different funds when they disappear, so that's where the 850,539 comes from. A lot of our savings are realized through looking at our operations and our business plans and where we can look for more efficiencies, where we can look for streamlining our business operations. And because we were able to do that, our net result in our FTEs is zero. So we won't be losing any staff in our proposed budget reductions. Again, those operational efficiencies have equaled cost savings. Again, our timeout publication is online. If our residents will go there today, some people think today's tax day. We call it registration day in our department. Registration begins today, and residents can go to mesaaz.gov. Follow the Parks and Recreation page, go to the timeout brochure, and if they click on the printable version, there's over 146 activities for families to participate in this summer. Our park maintenance operations, we can continue to look at that and consolidating those operations. All of our maintenance operations are now maintained out of the Decatur office. What that's done is allow us to better utilize our staffing levels, better use our equipment. And what it's really created is a consistent level of maintenance and service throughout all the city's parks. Our strategy, even through this new economy, remains the same, to focus on protecting and maintaining our existing assets. to offer the most popular programs in our recreation centers and in our parks to ensure that we're capitalizing on maximum registrations, to continue to collaborate with community partners, and to make sure that our programs truly add value to the quality of life for the residents of Mesa. I think it's important to always highlight the amount of space that's out there, the amount of opportunities there are for people to get outside and be active, whether it's in our lighted sports complexes, to the 56 playgrounds we have, to the more than 1,200 acres of developed space. We remain focused on our core recreation offerings, from the 8 swimming pools, our aquatics programs, the city's 4 recreation centers, our extremely popular adaptive recreation programs and adaptive sports programs, and really trying to tie back special events again through our community days of plays and really bringing the community back together through our city parks. And I think it's important when you look at those amenities that are out there, it's important that during these economic times that we realize how important the recreational opportunities when they're located close to home, they become even more relevant. Our aquatic season begins with the opening of all 8 pools on May 29th, and our swim lessons begin June 1st. This season, per council's direction, we'll also begin implementing a non-resident fee so that Mesa residents continue to get the best price at their facilities. We'll also be introducing a new senior fee discount on pricing to encourage that all people of all age get out and recreate. Our recreation programs continue to be very popular, from our youth and teen activities, our senior activities, our after-school programs, again, the adaptive programs, our fun and fitness mobile recreation unit, and our special interest classes. And staff remains even more dedicated to ensuring that we're providing a quality product for our residents. Our commercial facilities continue to look at innovative ways to attract visitors and programs at our various venues. We're working with one position in particular on our staff to really increase our efficiency by focusing directly and working with the CVB to attract out-of-state tournaments in all sports to help drive the economic development in the city.
Yeah, Mark, maybe you may just spend a quick second as to why tournaments and things like that are really a very well-kept secret and how important they are to Mesa and its economy.
Absolutely, Mayor. Anytime we can get out-of-state visitors in, not only are they playing on our fields, they're recreating, and there's a rental fee for those opportunities. They're also eating in our restaurants. They're staying in the city hotels, and spending money in the other shopping venues throughout the city. So really, our job is to get them here, keep them happy, get them to keep coming back and renewing those tournaments so they really drive that economic dollar throughout
the
entire
city. Yeah, and especially youth tournaments. I was amazed. I know Mark Yarbrough, who was head of the regional Little League, we had a Little League regional tournament, and he told me the effect, because when you have a youth come in, you usually have one or both parents. A lot of times you have siblings, and you have multiple chaperones or coaches or other things, and it was amazing the economic impact that had with, especially in our hotels and our eateries and that type of thing. So
absolutely
appreciate that
very
effort.
Important.
And that's something that's going on throughout, and I know that with our pool facilities, we've been especially aggressive in attracting very high-level regional and national competitions that, once again, that's all out-of-city money that's coming in and filling the coffers right. of our local businesses and
that's
small businesses.
Off our list is the pool, is Keel Complex.
Yeah, because actually, you know, the pools are really a twofer. They're, in many ways, they're a commercial facility in addition to being we really get dual use out of those. Councilmember Summers.
Well, there's also a public safety and health issue related to that. My children learn not to drown mm-hmm. in Mesa Public Schools. That is, they learn to swim Mesa Public Pools at Brim Hall. And the senior programs help with mobility. It improves health and fitness. And I think there was a fitness program this weekend going on here in Mesa. Unfortunately, I missed it. But, that reduces stress, reduces injuries, reduces 911 calls, helps prevent drowning. So they're important programs for that as well.
Absolutely, Mayor, Council. I appreciate those comments. And Councilmember Summers, the Shape Up Arizona event that you referred to, we had more than 3,000 people at that event alone, as well as 300 Special Olympians at Mesa High just down the road. So it was a busy weekend.
Yeah, I wanted to go to that, but I was out of state with my wife.
And Mayor, you mentioned the swimming pools. Yeah, that's a perfect example of community partnership between the school district, the city, and then working with the CVB to get those outside groups when we both have downtime in there. An example of that is CVB just sent out requests to colleges and universities looking for winter swimming programs for time for where they could come in. That was sent out on Friday. By Tuesday morning, they had 26 responses requesting interest in coming to Mesa during the winter break period for the colleges to do their training here. So, again, continuing to propel those opportunities. Back to the commercial facilities and looking at attracting people. Again, Cubs spring training was, again, the highest average daily attendance throughout the Cactus League, so we continue to be the leader in providing a quality product. We're looking forward to hosting the WAC baseball tournament May 17th through the 23rd. Dobson Ranch Golf Course was, again, voted the best municipal course in Arizona by Golf Digest. Riverview Golf Course continues to be one of the best values in the valley and offers a great golf experience. We're looking forward and hoping that the convention industry rebounds soon and we can start attracting more groups and the association business back into Mesa to get them to start utilizing the facility again.
Which, by the way, I got a letter from the quilters.
Mm-hmm.
And that may sound like it was amazing when I went to the quilter show, and they bring what 5-10,000 people in. It was huge. Yeah. And they really appreciated the work that our city staff did and said this is their favorite place and they want to make this a permanent home. So we'll be talking about that.
Good, we appreciate it.
I'll talk to you about that because they would love to make it here. And when you look and see the exhibits that are there and the passion that the quilters have, and the fact that they bring in thousands of people from around not only the state, but they had people from all over the Southwest. And I think the winning quilt was from a woman that came out of the Northeast. I mean, there are people out of state and out of the region that come in for that. So those are good things. Those are great things to have. They seem little, but they're big because they fill hotels and they bring a lot of people in.
Absolutely, Mayor, and those are the things you talk about, the retention. We're confident that once we can get the groups in here, that just as you mentioned, the delivery of service and that quality customer care and the quality of their facilities, we can continue to retain them and get them to do multiple bookings year over year. And again, working at the AMP, we continue to explore partnerships with area concert promoters to get more and more groups there. So we'll continue to push that.
Just throw something out. I was at the Muse concert last weekend, and Muse from the thing said last year we were in Mesa at the amphitheater with 4,500. So no one understood him with his British accent, but I heard him. And, yes.
Yeah.
So just want to share. We had a little PR.
Yeah, you know,
from them.
It's interesting when you go back over the last, let's say, 20 years and look at the groups that have played the amphitheater, or even other small venues. And the amphitheater isn't a really small venue. They're 3,000-4,000 people in there, but still, it's not U.S. Air or was it Jobbing or U.S.
No, U.S. Air.
U.S. Air Arena. It's amazing the number of now what are mainline international acts that have played the amphitheater.
Absolutely, and a lot of them, just as you mentioned, Councilmember Higgins, will refer back to the first time they came through when they were getting big, was at the AMP.
Yeah. They love playing it.
Yeah.
So we'll continue to get them there and hopefully continue to increase that business. And again, finally, in this new economy, we recognize we need to capitalize on our partnerships. We listed a few of them up there, and we're continuing to seek out those opportunities to truly build community throughout Mesa and work with everybody to provide those quality parks, recreation, and leisure services.
Great. Councilmember Fenter.
Just want to express my appreciation just for that culture, that sense of community. I've watched the parks really do some great things and utilizing just from a fiscal standpoint, being smart about how they manage things, and the message gets out to the community. I'm going on my third generation, hopefully with grandkids here this summer, of being able to enjoy the parks and all the good things it does. So when you talk about heart and soul in a community, this is important, and I get it. So I'm hoping that we don't miss any opportunities, and thanks for the service, everybody over there.
Thank you, Council Member.
Any other questions? you guys are great at doing a lot with a little. We understand that you're resource challenged, and we know that our parks are showing that. And that's not for lack of effort. We know that you're like every other department. You're struggling. We appreciate the dedication and the commitment that our parks employees have. I mean, I've had the opportunity to work with several of them in events and working with outside groups, and I'll tell you, it's been just across the board a great experience. You got great people working there, and we know that they're really trying to make do. Our parks are important to our community, and I know that every member of this, I'm speaking for every member of this council, that we wish we had resources that would be that our city deserves, and we hope that that returns soon, that we can really put money in the parks, because I don't think there's anyone who doubts the value of having a healthy and vibrant park and recreation system. That's what the community really enjoys. So thank you for all that you do.
Thank you, Mayor. I appreciate those words, and we'll make sure we relay that message back to staff, and great. I know they appreciate it as well.
Councilman Richens?
Just real quick, appreciate under the 12-slide limit, didn't read his slides. I think your first presentation to council gets an A. Very well. Although you could have used more pretty pictures, but, you know, that's okay.
That takes more ink. That takes more ink. That's part of our efficiency program.
I'm just impressed that you turned a budget cut discussion into a positive commercial for Parks and Rec. So well done.
Thank you. And the Vice Mayor pointed out that there's not a whole lot of acronyms in here either.
It's because I'm still trying to learn all the acronyms.
May you never be so educated. And Stacy, thank you for sitting there and
sure, no
playing the support role. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Appreciate it. Next item is Ms. Heather Wolf. Thought you'd left. I'm glad you're still here. And by the way, Heather's presentation is checked out only till tomorrow, so please return it on time.
Thank you.
Oh, is it?
Great volunteer.
Okay.
Good morning, Mayor Smith, Council. I'm Heather Wolf, Library Director, and this is Kate Havris, our Assistant Library Director. We have a short presentation as well, but I'm sorry, no pretty pictures. But under 12, absolutely. Our 5% target reductions for the library amount to just over $360,000. We avoided the personnel services portions of the budget and were able to find it in two main areas of the library's budget. First of all, we hit the other services lines. We hit a number of them from $500 on up, but listed here we have the major contributors to that $90,000 that we found there. Materials processing, telephone, and supplies are three areas that we hit pretty hard. Our commodities area contributed the bulk of the $360,000, coming in just over $270,000. We will be reducing the materials and supplies that we purchase outside of the warehouse, and our non-capital assets are also making up the bulk of that particular reduction. The library has already implemented a number of cost-saving measures this particular year. Obviously, one thing about having fewer staff is you have fewer supplies being used, so we've seen a significant decrease there. We're also looking at our costs. One recent savings that we found is we used to place two barcodes on items, one barcode for checking out, one barcode as backup, because barcodes often got damaged and were unreadable. At 22 cents a barcode, it doesn't seem like much, but now that we have the, and I won't use the acronym, Radio Frequency Identification System, or RFID, we only need one barcode, and the savings adds up to between $8,000 and $9,000. So I'm proud of staff for identifying that particular savings. Another thing that staff have done is we've really looked at what we have existing and readapting and repurposing those things. For those of you who visit the main library, the circulation desk there was very large. It kind of blocked the lobby area, and it wasn't ergonomically effective for staff to use it. We dismantled that and we used existing desks from around the library. It's much more open and airy and welcoming for our public. They're finding their way more easily, and it's the appropriate size for staff, so we're finding that they're more comfortable working long periods of time there. So great thing that we did, and it cost us no money in new purchases. So very proud of staff for finding that. Other things that we've done is we've started purchasing used retail shelving. Marketing in libraries has become very important. We're trying to become more like bookstores. We're trying to do things like slat wall displays and that sort of thing. And we've identified some local businesses that sell used retail. It saves us thousands of dollars instead of buying the items new. So we're excited about that. And finally, one thing about having three locations, you discover that one library is placing an order for supplies, and another library has a stash in a back closet. So we're consolidating orders. We're trying to order things just as we need them instead of stockpiling. And again, we're able to save some money that way. And that's really the budget portion of this presentation. I just want to make a little plug for the library. The usage has gone up this year, and that's our next slide. So far, since July of this year through March, we circulated over 1.7 million items. That's a 5% increase over the same period last year. We've had over a million people through our doors, which is...
And last year was an increase over the previous year, as I
correct.
Recall. So we're continued trend of increase year over year over
yes.
year, even with reduced hours.
Even with reduced hours, yes, yeah. exactly. So we're excited about the over a million people. That's a great number to hit before you're even finished with the fiscal year. So, and that was a 7% increase over last year. And finally, I want to make a plug for the staff. They've really worked hard on programming this year. There was a lot of concern with the reduced hours not being open on Sundays and the shorter evening hours of how are we going to do adult programming. But we've come up with a great partnership that we have with several different organizations, and we doubled program attendance this year. So we had almost 11,000 people so far attend programs. So staff have worked hard on that, and I want to make sure you guys know that we doubled our program attendance over last year. Finally, continuing in upcoming programs. Again, these are partnerships. The Development and Sustainability Department has put together a great series, the Living Green Series. I know several council members have attended some of those programs. We've drawn over 700 people with the programs we've had so far. That continues into July. We've also partnered with the Mesa Historical Foundation and the Arizona Museum for Youth. They've been putting displays in the libraries that coordinate with exhibits that they have ongoing. Right now we're hosting the Play Ball exhibits. Those are fun, and we're really looking forward to the Hallelujah Hats exhibits in the summer. Finally, we have the Mesa Express Library upcoming. We've started referring to it as MEL, so there's an acronym for you.
No, but see, that's okay, because you explain it, and then you use the acronym.
Okay.
So you got it in the right order. You're doing
okay.
well.
Well, good. Anyways, we're staff are excited about that. We're having fun picking shelves and interior, planning the interior spaces. So we're looking forward to opening the doors hopefully around summertime with that. And speaking of summer reading program is coming up May 17th. So hopefully get your friends and neighbors and family members into the library. It's a great program. We've got lots of fun activities related to that. And if you have teens, 12 and up, our volunteer coordinator is always looking for volunteers, so great activity for teens over the summer.
Heather, we got several council members. So we'll start with the Vice Mayor and go to Councilmember Kavanaugh, then Councilmember Fenter.
And Heather, I want to hats off to you for looking at these ways to still save money when in years past we have had to have draconian cuts in staffing and revamping hours. And yet you've still been able to come up with a reduction and still maintain those positions, because we really can't cut any more positions.
Correct.
So your presentation, Mark's presentation, where we're not cutting staff, but we're still finding ways to make that reduction is incredible. And I congratulate you for that. And to have the increase in participation and visits and still, you know, they say doing more with less, and you've been doing an outstanding, marvelous job at that. And congratulations.
Thank you so much, Vice Mayor.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you again. A great presentation. We have a real issue, I think, that we've talked about at times with the city participating in the Maricopa County Library District. And we're very much a donor city. And correct me if I'm wrong on my figures, but I think Mesa residents pay, what, almost $2 million a year?
Around $1.7
million. $1.7 million, yes. And the city gets $29,000 back before from that contribution. Yeah. And basically, I guess if you look at it one way, the city of Mesa is helping subsidize the Sun City Library. And I know Mr. Butler's here as well, and this needs to be an ongoing discussion, I think, for us mayor and council on the inequitable distribution of funds for library purposes when we get basically nothing back. Other communities that choose to be unincorporated are sucking our money and using it for their purposes. I know there was legislation introduced this year to address the issue, but I understand it got hung up because of a senator who represents Sun City. Am I correct, Mr. Butler?
There are a lot of, Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh, there are a lot of competing interests right now going on with some of the areas like Sun City where there's critical concern about their funding if this were to pass. Actually, the legislation that ended up being introduced a few weeks ago took care of the concerns of Sun City. It was unfortunately Maricopa County who blocked the bill and was able to convince the sponsor of the bill to withdraw it based on the fact that, in their words, it would decimate the Maricopa County Library District and they would have to shut down and become insolvent if this were to pass. But it's certainly an equity issue that is really a gross movement of funds out of the larger cities to subsidize libraries outside of those areas. It's happening in Phoenix, it's happening in Mesa, in Scottsdale, and it's got to stop. And we've been trying to work with the county for 4 years through the MAG process to try to come to some answer on this, some kind of resolution, and still they continue to rebuff all attempts to come to some kind of solution on this. So we're left with having to pursue this legislatively. Two attempts were made this year. The county was successful in blocking those. Senator Linda Gray from Phoenix has already stated that she will introduce a bill next year, and she wants to get this bill passed because as a Phoenix resident, she doesn't like the arrangement and what's happening to Phoenix libraries that she's paying into this, like all Mesa taxpayers or property owners do, and not getting an equitable return on their investment. It would even be easier for us council member if we were to have an opt-out provision where Mesa could opt out of the program and be able to even levy our own assessment, because it would be better if this assessment's being levied that we could do that just as a city and have it go to our libraries, because people are paying the fee now, they're just not getting a benefit.
Thank you. Councilmember Richens.
What about going the other direction, making all libraries county libraries and the city getting out of the library business?
Certainly I think Heather could probably address that there, and that has been discussed. That's actually Maricopa County's proposal. I think the concern is, though, you take away some of the unique characters. Our library system in the city is older than the Maricopa County system. It's an established part of our community, and to give up that identity and some of the unique programs and opportunities that our libraries provide in order to put it into a larger system, I think causes some concerns. And again, Heather could probably answer
that. And you're dancing around it also. Most of the people I know, and there are incorporated cities that contract with the county to run their libraries in their cities, and most of them are less than satisfied with the system they have. And I think that's one of the big roadblocks with going to a larger system. I think it makes sense if you just look at a service model, but right now, people I've talked to are the larger system has not lived up to their expectations. I think the reluctance is not only the desire to keep local programs, but also they just don't believe that the larger system can be as efficient and do the things that Heather and her staff have done, for example.
I guarantee you.
I mean, we have what we would be doing is that in Mesa we would be paying more for much less. And I think that's the fear we have. I mean, if we could have the kind of performance that that Heather and her staff have provided, I'd be all for it. But I'm a little worried that we have not seen the kind of performance out of the regional county system that would entice me to do that.
Mayor, and to that point, that Maricopa County likes to point to Pima County as an example because Pima County is consolidated. But the nature of Pima County and one dominant city in the county is very different than the nature of Maricopa County. And so we've said you can't.
Well, the other thing about Pima County is that, yeah, they have one dominant city, but also as many, if not more, people live in the county in an urban area as live in the city. So It's much different than the Maricopa County model. It's a lot different.
And Mayor, it's also important to note, I think, that the legislative proposal, just to show you, well, two points to that. First, the legislative proposal called for a 60-40 split. We even said the system can continue. We'll subsidize county 40%. All we're asking for is that 60% of the money generated within Mesa boundaries stay within the city. That was agreed to them. The other component to this, which is even more troubling, is that out of the county library fund, 30% of that fund was transferred into the county general fund last year.
No.
There's not a statutory barrier?
There is not. It's at the discretion of the Board of Supervisors.
Because they serve as the board for both the county library and the interesting. Councilmember Fenter.
Well, I just wanted to thank Heather and her staff. There's a tremendous leadership coming from the libraries. There's no organization that's been more negatively impacted over the last few years as the library system. Not only have you risen, you didn't go off kicking and screaming, you came back, you've risen to the challenge, you're providing innovative service models in the Mesa Express Library. Just so many good things that I often talk to naysayers out in the community, and I now point to you and to what's going on there of what can be accomplished. So I hope it isn't ever lost of the great job that you guys are doing in the community. And to let everybody know that's over there, a valuable asset, a great part of Mesa. It is not something to be cut and gotten rid of. It's to be celebrated and incorporated in just smartly. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you very much.
And thank you. And you guys have really made lemonade out of lemons. And I know that lemonade's great, but when you force-fed lemonade, it gets tiring. So this is sort of a mixed blessing. I mean, I would prefer not to be sitting here telling you what a great job you've been doing because you've been cut so much. But the fact is as Councilman Fenter so aptly put it, you know, you didn't, I know it's been tough, but we haven't heard, we haven't heard you come in and really remind us on a consistent basis how tough it's been. You've come in and remind us that, yeah, we got it. We understand the reality. Here's what we're going to do. You know, it's exemplary.
Thank you.
And just like with the parks, we hope that someday we can help you catch up, because I know that I know there's a lot of baling wire and chewing gum being used at the library system. And we'd really love to come in and be able to plug the holes. And even though it's an event that happened, we would normally report it in events, but the volunteers that give to our library service, library system are just incredible. And Councilmember Higgins and I and Mr. Brady and Ms. Kent had the opportunity to go to the library volunteers recognition luncheon last Saturday, and it was a great event to see the people who, how many people do you have over 20 years service?
We have several. There's probably almost 10. So yeah. a second career.
Well, and the amazing thing is that the couple I was sitting next to, the gentleman, 26 years, they moved from Mesa many years ago.
And they still come.
And they moved out to Sun City.
Yes.
And they still drive back into Mesa to volunteer. And so that's a day trip. They easily could have given up, but that's how much they love our system and our community. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay. Thank you. Next item. We'll hear now from the Development and Sustainability Department.
Sustainable Development.
Good morning, Ms. Solanka.
Good morning, sir. Mayor and Council, my name is Christine Zalanka with the Development and Sustainability Department. John Wesley, our planning director, is here today. I've also got our deputy directors, Steve Heather, Tammy Albright, Scott Boucher and Beth Huser-Nellis are here to answer any questions that you might have. I would like to point out that you have 11 sheets in front of you, but two of them don't count. just 2 years ago.
Wait a second.
Yes.
What do you mean two of them don't count?
Well, I'm going to share that. The first one doesn't count. That's introductory. The last one's questions.
You have to share it, and then that means they do count.
But they're.
But we'll give you a pass on that.
They've actually borrowed six from the library.
Oh,
yeah, there you go.
Library.
Yeah. So it's a wash. We're good.
They have to return them by tonight.
They have to return those little slides by tonight. Okay. Thank you.
2 years ago, we actually adopted the mayor's slogan, which is building a better Mesa, and we decided that it actually starts here with our department. We are the initial point of contact for new development, and we have absolutely bought into that concept and continue to use it as sort of our overarching vision. So that's the slide that does not count. We
I should be.
The department has
I
been.
I tried to, and they told me it wasn't in their budget.
The department has been through major changes, reorganization, streamlining, and consolidation the last 2 years, so I thought it was important just to remind you exactly what the current department does look like. We have four major areas. The planning area is responsible for the general plan, zoning code, administration, zoning cases, general entitlements. That group has also, over the last 2 years, taken over historic preservation, which used to be in another department, and we have also assumed responsibility for planning in the downtown area. Development services is one of the major coordination functions across city departments. This group, led by Beth Huser-Nellis, is responsible for really coordinating and collaborating with developers early on in the process, looking at off-site requirements, coordinating utility requirements, new road improvements, and they are a central point of contact to coordinate city comments and city requirements to new development. They also have assumed responsibility for managing and tracking development agreements, city share agreements, buy-in agreements, that kind of thing. That was development planning. Development services is quite a diverse group these days. They're responsible for building permit review and issuance. They man the call center. We have all of the calls that come in for building inspections, code compliance, planning issues, and environmental complaints coming through our call center. So we manage that. The front lobby, where we have our walk-in customers, they're responsible also for building and zoning plan review. And we've taken on code compliance, which is a portion of that department or that division now. You've heard a lot about the coordination of building inspections and code inspections. And they also do environmental compliance inspections on construction sites. The Environmental and Sustainability Department is a sort of a reconfigured and reconstituted group over the last year. They're still responsible for environmental compliance activities across the city, but they've taken on the energy and water conservation efforts, and they are responsible for managing approximately $4.2 million in stimulus funding that we received last year, and those programs will continue over the next couple of years. I thought it was important to just emphasize how much of our activity is directly related to economic conditions. This is not anything new, but I thought it was important to kind of look at where we've been over the last several years. From 2004, this slide demonstrates the total construction valuation versus the number of permits, and we've gone from about $1.6 billion in construction valuation in the city back in 2004 down to just over $2 million. Number of permits has decreased from a high of 9,500 back in 2005 down to about 3,000 anticipated for this year. Over the last 2 years, we've been through significant staff reductions. Wanted to just show the level of consolidation that the department has gone through. Our planning area, we've gone from 55 planners down to currently 9. In our development services and development administration, we currently have 41 people left. Overall, as a department, we've gone from over 188 staff positions down to our current level of 66.5 FTEs. Another way to look at just the current economic condition and how it directly affects Mesa, this shows the relationship between new commercial development, residential, and then total, and the last three quarters on the graph there for first quarter one from 9/10 through the third quarter shows that we continue to really see a decline in the commercial area. We're seeing a little bit of activity in residential, but again, the overall construction activity is down significantly. Although we've been significantly downsized, we really do feel that based on the current economic situation, we're probably right-sized. We are still able to hit the published turnaround times that we have on plan review. With our 410 schedule, the published turnaround time on large commercial is 18 days, 10 days for small commercial and residential. And for the most part, we hit those turnaround times 100% of the time with our existing staff. Inspections is another critical part of the department, and again, this is both building inspections and code inspections. What I wanted to point out here is the huge increase between December and January of 2009 in the number of inspections per inspector, and that's really when we had the major reduction in workforce. So each individual had to take on many more inspections than they had previously been doing. If you look between December and January of 2009, the relatively large increase there. We had six inspectors. We are eliminating one of the positions due to retirement, not refilling that. So we're down to five building inspectors. So that's the increase in January of 2010 that you see there. In code compliance, again, saw a significant reduction in the number of officers back in 2008, 2009. So you see the decline in new open cases. I just wanted to point out the increase in new open cases for the last two quarters in code compliance. That top line there is due primarily, we have two contract code inspectors that we've been able to bring back with CDBG funding just for this year. And we've initiated a pilot program on weed control. As you all know, we've got a huge problem because of the rain this year. And in response to complaints, we're actually sending out letters as a way of maximizing our efficiency. So that's the big increase that you see there.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
I think I have a question on code compliance issues.
Yes,
because we do have a large number of the code compliance officers funded by CDBG funds. With the budget situation, I understand we have a situation that's developed just because of budget issues at this time, or at least from last month forward, that in effect we almost have kind of a brownout of the CDBG or the funded code positions, in that they're only going to be responding to complaints. I'm not wording this correctly. In terms of calls from outside the CDBG area, isn't there a limited availability of those code compliance officers who are funded through
CDBG? Right. We currently only have one code inspector that's from the general fund. All of the remaining officers have to work in the CDBG areas. And what?
So that's at least a limitation that we have by choosing that source of funding. In effect, really, for the final quarter of the fiscal year, we've got some significant, I think, barriers for some of our work.
That's actually been the case the entire year. The CDBG-funded positions have been there all year. Mm-hmm. What TAMI does actually is manage a percentage of time between the code officers and the building inspectors to, again, mm-hmm. try to maximize their efficiency. But you're absolutely right. We only have one dedicated funded code officer that works outside of the CDBG areas.
All right. Thank you.
Mayor.
Councilman Fenter.
Thank you, Mayor. And as a follow-up, we did do some cross-training with our building inspectors, and that is a big change in how we did things, but trying to utilize highly trained folks to do it, real positive in my mind, at least, in how we do that. So, and we'd love to hear how that's going and how that's
okay.
working. And so,
Councilman Richens.
I wanted to give you a guy's compliment on the way you've handled code over the last year. It used to be the biggest, when I first got on council, it was the biggest thing citizens would call and complain about, either how they were treated at the code process or they didn't feel like they were getting any response. That has completely evaporated, and that's due to good management. And so I want to give you guys a lot of credit and kudos for the great job that you're doing there. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vice Mayor?
While we're at a pause in your presentation, I'll have a question then. Back on your turnaround times, where you've been meeting that goal, basically 100% mm-hmm. of the time frame. My question is, how many repeats do we have? How good are we at being able to utilize the same plan reviewer? Because we had a problem in the past, not just Mesa, but generally, where you might not have the same plan reviewer and there's different requests made when they redline something. How are we doing to minimize that? Because even in the turnaround time, how many are repeats? How many multiple reviews are we having to do?
I'm going to let Steve Heather answer that question.
Vice Mayor Jones, Mayor Smith, for the most part, the same plan reviewer is assigned for the multiple submittals. It's obviously more efficient because they're familiar with it.
Right.
And right now, because I only have five plan reviewers, it's not hard to keep those assigned back to that person. As far as the, I think the question you had is the number of resubmittals.
Right. How you know, time frame wise, once we get them, we're getting them back out. But how frequently are we reducing the resubmittals? As, I mean, we can't control that completely, yeah. But I'm talking about from our end. Where
We are doing everything we can as far as redlining the documents to get them out and things without requiring a resubmittal. We are experiencing some quality issues simply because the private sector, we're seeing contractors who perhaps have never done, say, commercial work or anything like that, trying to compete with that. Architects and engineers who have moved out of their particular expertise trying to get other things, and so we're working a lot with educating those folks when we're seeing that there are problems in the submittals.
Okay. I guess my biggest question was then, are we getting the same plan reviewers so that we're not making changes on them? Because like I say, in years past, that became problematic.
Yes, we are, as much
okay.
as possible.
Thank you.
I can just respond anecdotally. Typically, when we have had those kinds of problems in the past, the developer will call me and let me know that I've got a problem. I've not been getting those kinds of calls. I think we really have focused on consistency. Steve has done a tremendous job of cross-training his plan reviewers so that they all are basically starting from the same page, that they're interpreting codes consistently. So I really do think we've made some major improvements in that area, primarily through Steve working with his staff to make sure they are interpreting code consistently.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And I will back that up because in the nearly 2 years that I've been in office now, I can tell you that, and part of this is, of course, because of the volume, but I can tell you that the war stories I get back from my many friends in the development industry are much different now than they were back
right.
then. I mean, your whole department's made an incredible change and progress in really changing the way you did business, and it's being noticed. It really is. I'm getting good reports back. And you know, we're not perfect. We're human.
We're not.
But I think people recognize that, and whereas before there was sort of a hopelessness, as is with many government activities. Now, when I hear something that's less than a favorable experience, they'll always put a qualifier in there that says, but you know what, things have changed a lot, and I feel like everyone is really working at doing better. So, I mean, I got to tell you, it's been great to get those kind of stories.
Right.
So, congratulations. Thank you for that.
Certainly makes my life easier.
Yeah. You know, it's funny how when you do things that way, it does make jobs easier. And increases efficiency, too.
Absolutely. So. And I've got a couple of ideas on that I'm going to share coming up
Good.
Here. If we can move on to environmental and sustainability. Again, we've seen some major expansion in this area. We've actually changed the name of the department to Development and Sustainability to really focus on the concept and the aspirational goals of sustainable development across the city. All of the environmental compliance activities are funded by the environmental fee. That's a fee that's attached to every utility bill. We are not proposing any increase in the environmental fee this year. Just to remind you which programs are funded, air quality, our PM10 dust programs, ozone, carbon monoxide are funded under that. Hazardous materials management for city operations, stormwater quality, and I do have an acronym, but if I had spelled this out, it would have taken two slides. So it's the Arizona Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. That's our stormwater permit under the Clean Water Act.
Thank you, Vice Mayor. What is exactly you do under the hazardous materials? Are those inspections, or what do you do?
Basically, and if Scott would like to come up, we help the other departments within the city manage hazardous materials to make sure that we're in compliance with the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act regulations, and also to some level OSHA regulations to make sure that we're managing hazardous materials properly.
Okay.
We coordinate disposal, make sure that departments are storing their materials in compliance with regulations.
And good examples when we're doing like cleanup over at the asbestos Escobedo homes, you all were involved in that, or if it's the train, you all
right.
were involved in those. So they become kind of our in-house consultants on handle the hazardous
material. Do you do annual inspections of facilities at
Yeah, we do annual inspections of the facilities. A good example would be the East Mesa Service Center is considered a small quantity generator for hazardous waste because of all the different operations out there, that there's hazardous waste that's generated through those operations. So we're doing annual inspections out there. There's a standard operating procedure for that area. And then we coordinate all the disposal of the hazardous waste from those areas.
Okay, thank you. Also, more comments at the end. Thanks.
Okay. One of the other programs that we continue to work on developing is brownfields. Scott has done a tremendous amount of work at the old tally site in Councilmember Higgins' district and has leveraged city resources by getting a lot of volunteer help at the state level to try to work on that property. So we continue to try to move that program forward. From our environmental fee under the stormwater regulations, we also fund compliance activities of several other departments, including transportation, street sweeping, some of the park maintenance activities, some of the fleet support activities. Household hazardous waste collection is also another major event that our environmental group works collaboratively with the Solid Waste Management Department. Currently have four events per year. I think just about all of you have been out to those events. And that is all completely funded with the clean and green fee that's collected on solid waste bills.
On that, how did we do with splitting where we had appliances last Saturday and then there'll be the rest of the...
It's my understanding, based on speaking with the city manager, that there was not as much activity in the appliance collection this last week as there had been previously. Scott and Solid Waste will be evaluating that to see if it makes sense to continue to keep a separate function going, or do we have kind of picked up the slack in the system with appliances. So we're constantly evaluating the volume there to try to manage it.
I know several months ago out east, it was a nightmare because right. They were doing all the appliances, and that was when they first started doing the medical.
Correct.
Getting rid of pills, and it was almost a nightmare out there.
Right. So but we never closed the gate, and everybody got through.
Oh, that's right. Absolutely. Most of us were there.
Right.
So, great job. So, just an evaluation. I was just curious how it went with splitting it.
I believe there were just over 100 vehicles that were at the ACE event last week, and then we'll see on Saturday how our household hazardous waste event goes, because it's this Saturday.
So we're looking for volunteers if anybody'd like to come out Saturday morning and help.
But with the appliance, that was mostly the recycling company that was there. We had to have staff, obviously, for the facility to have it open, but the majority of the work done was by the recycler who was taking the appliances.
That is correct. And we have, when after the last event, we added the prescription drugs, and we did have those long lines. We did make operational changes also where we added a separate line. We're not as collecting as much information as we used to at the gate to try and move it along. And really, by that next event, we had gotten our wait times back down into the 10-15-minute range, which over the 10-year history of that program, that's happened several times that we've had one event that we realize it's just outgrown the way that we had to run the event previously. You have long wait lines. We get together. We kind of reorganize, figure out ways that we can get people through quicker, and it's grown over the years. So I'm sure it'll continue to do that, and we'll have changes sometime in the future again.
All right, great. Thank you.
The other side of the environmental and sustainability operation is currently the water and resource conservation. A significant portion of that is enterprise funded. The Water Use It Wisely program is funded through the Water Resources Group. We also have a number of grants there that are collaborative grants with Phoenix, Tempe, and also Mesa Public Schools. As you know, that group does a tremendous amount of outreach, including Heather referenced the Living Green series that's been extremely popular with our residents. We spoke previously about the stimulus funding, the Energy Efficiency Conservation Grant Program. That's approximately $4.2 million. That's a very collaborative program across many departments, including water resources, energy resources, engineering, transportation, and facilities. The main areas that we're looking at there are energy conservation in city facilities, solar installation, the Central Main Street Plan, which we're excited about developing a plan associated with transit along Main Street as the light rail comes through, and then eventually looking at the possibility of adopting an energy code for the city of Mesa. Wanted to talk a little bit about our development planning group. Again, as I mentioned, that is a group that represents the other departments in the initial phases of development. The transportation portion of it, street improvements, is a significant portion of what they do with developers as they come in, also water and energy resources. And one of our proposed budget modifications is to more accurately allocate the cost to the programs that are actually being served there. So one of our proposals is that we split the funding to allocate it to the enterprise funds and transportation there, again, to reflect the service that's actually being provided for those departments. Our baseline budget for fiscal year 2010-11 started at $5.9 million. The proposed general fund budget reduction that we're proposing is just over $380,000. Again, a major portion of that is more accurate cost allocation to other enterprise funds that use our services, and then the one building inspector position that we are going to eliminate, taking us from six down to five. Again, that was a retirement, but we're proposing that we eliminate that position. I wanted to speak briefly about a couple of future issues that are coming up. Under our stormwater permit program, we just received about a week and a half ago a new stormwater permit from Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. We've actually been negotiating that permit for approximately 10 years. Mr. Boucher was finally successful in bringing it to conclusion. We will have significant new regulatory mandates under that permit, and I've summarized them in this chart for you. The major one, we've got an increased number of industrial inspections. We currently do approximately 8 per year. We're going to have to do 50, and this was the subject of many, many hours of negotiation with the regulatory agencies. That number was originally much higher than 50. Our sampling requirements, we are going to have to do more work as far as evaluating possible exceedances of water quality standards. We do actual sampling of stormwater in the summer and winter time. If we have an exceedance of a water quality standard, we are going to have to do more investigations. There's employee training requirements, and this is primarily for field staff to make sure that they understand if they see a potential pollutant entering our storm drain system that they notify environmental so we can follow up on it. Did you have a comment?
Oh, I was going to wait till you're done, but I can talk about it. I know we have other areas, fire. I know there's some in water quality and everything where we are looking at ways to take inspection and compliance issues that the city has performed the inspections and trying to find ways to move that to where there's a self-inspection or even a private sector inspection that takes it outside both our funding but also our cost or expense, mm-hmm. type of thing. I mean, I know on a very simple basis, for example, my backflow valve is a requirement, but mm-hmm. the city water department sends out a notice every year, and I, with a list of X number of subcontractors that I pay directly to come in and inspect it, and they send the inspection in the thing. I know in fire, has been brought up last during the fire deal, looking at ways that we can maybe accomplish some of these obligations that in many ways we created, but for example in this one is created by the state or by others. I have no idea about the details, and we don't need to get into these things, but I would hope that as these new obligations come to us, especially since they are in a sense unfunded mandates that come down from above us, that we look at ways for industries to either self-regulate or utilizing private entities that can provide these services where the transaction is between the company and the industrial site or whatever it is that's being done. I know that may not work across the board here, but I'd hope that you'd be looking at ways to do that.
If I could just respond to 2 points on that. Several years ago, we identified the issue of unfunded mandates relative to environmental regulations and the cost of those to the city. And that's why we implemented the environmental compliance fee. The revenue from the environmental compliance fee that all of our industry, all of our residents pays, actually goes and is dedicated to funding these compliance activities. We cannot, under the regulations, sort of contract away our regulatory obligations. We're still held responsible for the compliance activities. We actually, in the environmental budget, we contract out about half with outside services rather than having city staff do those functions. One of the issues that we have been looking at with very preliminary discussions with fire prevention on these industrial inspections in particular, to see if there's a way that we can collaborate if we've got one city inspector already out at an industrial facility with some additional training. Could that individual basically be handling both the fire prevention as well as the stormwater portion of it? Those are very preliminary discussions. But Councilmember Summers, did you have a question?
Yeah, Councilmember Summers.
Actually, you hit on a point that I was going to raise for Mr. Brady to consider as well at the end of this conversation was with our discussion, was it a week ago or so, in the cutbacks of fire prevention. We've done such a great job in cross-training when you combined all these departments, if perhaps some things, the hazardous materials inspections that we do are probably far more thorough than what the fire department does. Maybe there's an opportunity to cross-train there. It always drove me nuts that if you're putting in a fire sprinkler system, you had one inspector doing the plumbing and another inspector inspecting the fire sprinkler system. It's plumbing. It's water. It's in the ceiling instead of in the ground. I don't understand. It's just another barrier, I think, to development. In a way, creates another process. Maybe we can combine the two, and also plan review. I don't know why I have to pass it through two different departments. Perhaps we can combine some of that.
Okay, just a comment on that. Currently, plan review, we have fire plan review in development sustainability.
Yeah, I remember that discussion last year. That was a little bit of a
touchy.
Yeah, touchy.
Right. We handle that. Also, on the new construction inspections, we basically have the same inspector out there looking at the plumbing, at the sprinkler systems as part of new construction. What we're talking about here is after that, after they've been on operation, where fire prevention is going in and looking at hazardous materials storage, secondary containment, training, very similar kinds of issues to what we're required to look at under the stormwater permit. So it seems that there's probably an awful lot of overlap over there that can we send in one inspector afterwards rather than sending.
You guys have done a great job of looking for those opportunities, and I know you'll continue. Like I said, we don't need to get into the details.
Okay.
There's also something, some of these inspections I know we can move in certain instances, not in all, but in certain instances, where we still have responsibility, but rather than us performing all steps of inspection, we can in many cases inspect the inspector. You know, for example, I know in some of our, in fire, in some of our major industrial where we, you know, Boeing, for example, where they already have to, for the Department of Defense and for insurance and for other things, they already have inspections that even go beyond what we would normally do for fire. We go in and we basically just review what they've done. And we end up, we have the final responsibility and authority, but they're doing such a comprehensive job, it's silly for us to duplicate what's already been done. And I know you'll do a good job of looking for those opportunities because you have in the past.
Okay.
So I appreciate that.
Okay. Just next slide here. What we're proposing, again, under, we have approximately $200,000 that's unallocated in the environmental fee. And the additional resources that we've identified to comply with the new permit is that we need essentially the equivalent of one full-time position to do the inspections and the follow-up, and that's where we're talking to fire prevention at this point in time. Again, those are very preliminary discussions, and as that whole issue moves forward, we'll figure out what works best there. The one other thing, it'll be a one-time cost. We have a number of compliance plans that we have to prepare for city operations, basically standard operating procedures for our various compliance activities. We're proposing that we do bring a consultant in to develop those plans. We simply don't have the resources in-house. Once we have them developed, then we can maintain them over time with city staff. A couple of other things real quickly. Next year, we will start working on the major general plan update. The general plan has to be updated and go to the voters once every 10 years. So next year, we anticipate that we'll start updating that. That'll be primarily updating the land use changes that have occurred over the last 8-9 years and also the text changes. And obviously, Don will be running that program. That will require a public vote, and we'll need to take that to the voters in 2012. So again, we'll anticipate starting that process next year. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about, and Councilmember Jones, you mentioned it, just our interaction with the development community on plans. Technology has come so far in the last several years, and one of the major improvements that we're proposing is looking at electronic plan review. That will basically make a real-time interaction between a plan reviewer and an engineer or architect sitting in their office where they can look at what the plan reviewer is doing. They can talk about it. In many ways, it's kind of going back to the old red line days where you can put a cloud around something and say, what's going on with this? But they can do it electronically. It will avoid the problem of a plan reviewer making notes in our permitting system, then sending those over to the applicant. They have to interpret it, get back to us. We actually have a technology fee that we instituted a couple of years ago. It's a 4% charge on top of every building permit and planning permit, and it's dedicated by ordinance, can only be used for technology at the discretion of the city manager. So what we're proposing here is that we start an official feasibility study, do a request for proposal, and hopefully by the end of the year actually have a product available that we can institute. It'll be a tremendous increase in productivity. The cities I've talked to, the increase in productivity from a staff planner, anywhere between 25 and 50% improved productivity as opposed to moving around large pieces of paper. So we're excited about that, working with the development community on that, and I think it'll be a huge improvement in our operation.
Vice Mayor?
And unlike some other entities, we don't sweep funds that are designated for a specific use. Just thought I'd throw that in there. Okay.
Well, and we tried to preempt Mr. Odom on that one. We established the ordinance, and we actually said the city manager has to designate it for technology. A couple of other issues that obviously have been ongoing concern. We've talked to you about it. What happens with our reduced level of staffing when things start turning around? The ways we anticipate and have been responding to that, we have the ability to bring in temporary workers. We have on occasion brought back former workers, able to bring them through temporary service agencies. They've done both plan review, they've done inspections, and as I mentioned before, we've had code folks come back on a contract basis. We will continue to do that. We can use those individuals to respond to special needs. If we had a large project that came in that they wanted expedited service, I can bring somebody back in on a contract basis and get it done quickly. So we have that ability to negotiate those. We've also done a tremendous amount of staff training where I can take a plan examiner, if I've got a huge influx of people down in the call center or down in the lobby, we can take a plans examiner, have them go downstairs and issue a permit. So we're really continuing to look at those staff cross-training opportunities and how can we make the best use of our limited resources. That's the end of my 9-page presentation.
First one didn't count.
Sheet.
I loved your presentation. Your math abilities are suspect.
It's creative.
It's creative, okay.
Creative math.
Good. But I noticed that every time you count the pages, the number keeps going down. So that's good reduction. You're getting in the mental stage of reduction.
Yes,
thank you. And once again, the three departments we've had today, you guys have been leaders in really making do with less and yet still creating increases in service levels and increases in service efficiency and in the product that you get out. And I commend you for that.
Thank
you so very much. Appreciate it. And we're hoping that the last slide that you have a lot of I hope that in the next year you have gobs of problems figuring out how to handle the influx of new work that's coming in. That would be a wonderful problem to have.
We
hope you have it. We hope you have it.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, next item is the here reports on meetings and conferences attended. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Tuesday night I attended the 38th annual meeting for the Dobbs Ranch Homeowner Association. Didn't believe it was that old. Of course, I'm old and I've lived there for a long time, so I guess it must be. But one of the more interesting events that occurred this past week there was that Dobbs Ranch has completed its first rainwater harvesting project. And as you recall, Vice Mayor Glassman presented to us several months ago the idea of Tucson's rainwater harvesting ordinance, and I think the council gave some direction to explore those issues to come back to us at a later point. This new project at the La Casita Recreation Center will provide enough water to meet one half of the landscaping needs for that center. And it's a very creative example of what can be done to utilize this technology and these techniques in an arid environment. So I encourage you to look at that. And I know our staff provided some assistance and guidance to Dobson Ranch on that, and I appreciate that very much.
Thank you. It's good to hear. Anything else? Councilmember Higgins.
I just want to share that last week we lost a longtime Mesa businessman and my cousin-in-law, John Lindsay. John owned and operated the AMCO dealerships in Mesa for many years, and he was a fixture out there on East Main Street, and he will truly be missed. Thanks.
Okay. Anything else? One other thing that I'd like to note, someone told me at the start of the meeting today is Mr. Tom Verplugen's last day. And Mr. Verplugen, for the last 25 years, has led the what is now called the Downtown Mesa Association, and I would like to commend him and thank him for his many years of service to the Downtown Mesa community and to this city. He's been an active participant in this city, and moving on to a new opportunity in Oklahoma City, and we'll miss him. We're excited for his new opportunity, and we're excited for downtown to look at a new page. I mean, whenever you have change like that, it's really a positive thing for individuals and for organizations. And one of the comments I get from anybody who comes into our city is, you know, we tend to take our downtown for granted. At how it looks and how orderly and clean it is, no graffiti, no trash or very limited amounts of trash, and we tend to underappreciate the work that goes on from our downtown property owners and merchants as to what they do. And you know, there's just been a lot of exciting things starting to go on in downtown. Vice Mayor.
Along with that, Sharon Winter, who's been his office manager for many of those years, is retiring at the same time. So it'll be quite a shift in the office down there, but a big thank you to both of them.
And we thank them, appreciate them, wish them luck, a lot of luck in their new endeavors. So thank you for that. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor and Council, just to remind those on the Community and Neighborhood Services Committee meeting, there's a meeting right after the study session. We have the City Court grand opening event tomorrow at 10 a.m. So invite everyone to be there. We also have
with the retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
We'll be there also. And then just Saturday's very busy. District 4, Vice Mayor Jones has a pancake breakfast at Station 201. And we have our household hazardous waste collection, which was mentioned earlier, from 8 to noon at the Center Street facility. And then we want to make sure everybody's knows about the second annual Falcon Field Open House this Saturday, also from 8 to 3 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Crocker, are there any requests to speak from the public?
No requests, ma'am.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to enter into executive session. I have a motion from Councilmember Summers, second from the Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are now moving into executive session. Thank you so very much for everybody who presented this morning. Thank you.